When you want a little show and you don't know where to go, put on your headphones and hit the mark.
Hey guys, thank you for tuning in to Hit the Mark with Mark Levy. It's your host, Mark Levy. Of course, big shout out to Doug Weidick. That's his 41st episode of his theme song playing. If you want to listen to his brand new song that him and Ann Caligari made, it's called Valentine's for One. You know, tomorrow's Valentine's Day, so, yeah, you know, listen to it. It's really funny, and they're great, like usual. I believe it's at Forklift Comedy. If not, I will fix that later, but it's really funny. Look up Valentine's for One. Of course, big thank you to Austin Rye. I really enjoyed that episode. I enjoyed the response I've gotten from the episode already. It was great. It's great talking to our Florida actor, improviser, all that stuff, and just experience that stuff. Jeez, thank you, Austin. That was really great. I also want to plug again, before my plugs, of course, at the end, but Getting to Know You, episode 10, which is Christopher Berger and Leanne Linsky's podcast. I was on last Wednesday, like a week ago from today. Please download it. It's funny. I really enjoyed being on it. They were great hosts, and it was a fun 90-minute conversation. If you like this podcast, Hit the Mark with Mark Levy. Please go to iTunes and, rate, review us, subscribe. You know, if you like us on Facebook. If you want to donate some money, go to hitthemark.podomatic.com, and you can click our PayPal button and, you know, send a few dollars our way. And, you know, I mean, no matter what, thank you guys, because it's a free podcast, episode 41. I can't believe it. We have Connor Ratliff here today. Really excited about that. We're going to talk to him in a minute. First, I have to give my quick play review. I saw the play Collision by the Immoralist Theater Company. It's really cool. It reminded me a lot of Fight Club, but set in college, and not necessarily about the violence. It was about the human control. That's all I can really say about it without ruining the play. It closes this weekend. If you enter the code Blizzard Buddies at their website to buy a ticket, to get two tickets for $20 a piece, which is great. The show is really funny. It's really in your face. There's nudity. There's violence. There's vulgarity. All the things that make this theater geek's heart go pitter-patter. I say hits the mark. It's definitely a play you're going to want to discuss with someone, too. So I really say see the show. All right, so today's episode, like I said, has Connor Ratliff on it. If you didn't know Connor was on the episode until right now, then you didn't read the description or the title of the episode. But you might know him from The Stepfathers. You might know him from Chris Gethard's show as the presidential candidate, Connor Ratliff. And now the Olympics athlete, Connor Ratliff. And also, he's on a great web series called I'm Too Fragile for This, with future Hit the Mark guest, Catherine Mudon. Welcome, Connor.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Yeah, how have you been?
Pretty good. I like the snowy weather.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, you're also in Queens, so you know, like, how, like, it's crazy, the snow in Queens.
I mean, it gets gross really quick in New York, but I sort of feel if you go through a New York winter without getting some snow, it feels like a waste. It feels like you've skipped a beat.
Yeah.
I hate New York in the summertime because I feel like spring and autumn when it's sunny, New York's nice, but I feel like hot weather in New York, it feels like it's just not built for it. But when you look at how New York looks in the snow, it looks right to me.
I agree. I went to Astoria Park yesterday to play in the snow because since I'm from Florida where there is no snow, I figured I have to play in the snow every time there's a blizzard.
Right.
And I got a friend of mine, and we literally went and threw snowballs at each other, made snowmen. And, like, it was just so beautiful watching the city in that condition.
Yeah. The only thing I don't like is, if it were down to me, there would be some form of holiday decoration. Not Christmas necessarily, but winter decoration. Like, you can get rid of Santa Claus things, but, like, lights that look like snowflakes, I feel like you can keep those up till March if we're down to me. I like how festive it looks.
Yeah, I mean, it's cold, so the city doesn't warm up.
There's something sad about in January when they take New York is so beautiful from, like, Thanksgiving through Christmas. All those lights and everything are so nice to me that January feels slightly bleak because it's not as nicely illuminated.
Yeah, I completely understand, I was by Rockefeller Center, I think, like, a week after Christmas, and of course, all that beautiful stuff was just gone.
It's dire. It's so sad.
It's so sad.
And because I'm so sentimental. Yeah. Like I am a really sentimental person by nature, so when that ends, it just feels like, why? Why can't you just keep something nice over the life? When I was a kid, I once made my mom, we kept our Christmas tree up until Valentine's Day.
Do people say anything weird about it?
I don't think anybody came by during that period. Okay. It was just like us in our house, and I was just a little kid, and I was just like, please don't take it down. Like, I liked it so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still like that.
Well, see, the thing with my holiday is that it's just a menorah, and you can leave it out all year round. People just think it's a religious symbol, which it is.
And I'm completely secular Christmas, because I'm total agnostic. The things I tend to like in Christmas are all the secular characters who've been created, like, for advertising.
Yeah, like Santa Claus.
Like Santa Claus, Frosty Snowman.
The Coca-Cola, like, polar bears.
Yeah, they're all just, like, festive winter things that have nothing to do with any religion for me, so.
Well, that's nice.
Like the Peanuts, even though Charlie Brown Christmas is, like, one of the more, like, overtly religious
is it like the one of the most?
I think so. Well, just that you have Linus give that speech at the end from the Bible. But to me, like, that music in the Charlie Brown Christmas special, like, that is the ultimate Christmas mood setter for me. I have a second Vince Guaraldi album that's not Christmas music.
Holy.
That is like my it's my, in January, it's like my methadone clinic. It's like, oh, well, I feel stupid playing the Christmas music, but I'll play this, which has a similar kind of cool jazzy vibe.
You don't
vibe.
Want any guests to come by, you're listening to, like Jingle Bell Rock.
Right, or, absolutely not, yeah. I gotta go cold turkey.
Well, you know, it's good to ease yourself back into civilization after the winter months.
Yeah.
I don't like to ask many questions on the podcast, but I always like to ask, what was your big comedy inspiration as a kid?
As a kid, it would probably be old cartoons and
like Looney Tunes,
well, my dad hosted a he was a on a local TV station. He was the weatherman, and he hosted 5 days a week. He hosted a live kids show called Showtime.
That's so cool.
There's a few episodes of it online on my YouTube channel, the Connor Ratliff, whatever I've uploaded, because I am in a couple of episodes as a kid.
Oh, man. Like 7-year-old Connor is just...
Yeah, I would like co-host. I hosted an episode when I was 5. Basically, what it was from 3:30 till 4, Monday through Friday. It was a show he didn't originate. It started like in the 1950s and had He started it, I think, around the mid-70s through 1985. And it was a half hour live. It usually had a live studio audience of kids.
Right.
It was my dad and some puppets. And they would show that, like, you could, local TV stations could buy a package of cartoons.
Okay.
And they would literally get, like, 16 millimeter reels. Like, there was a library of, like, reels of Bugs Bunny cartoons, Popeye cartoons, and Little Rascal shorts. And so I grew up, like, I would go in. It was the best job that I could have had my dad have. I could go into this TV station, and I would sit in this little room in the back, and there was a little tabletop reel-to-reel thing that through a little monitor, and then a little sound, it would go through a little sound thing next to it, and you could, and I would play the, I would crank the cartoon, and I would do it slow and fast and backwards, and
that's
I would just
so
watch
cool.
these things.
Oh, man.
Every now and then, there were a few times when the film would break, and I knew how to splice it, but I remember there's one Bugs Bunny cartoon that the break was so long that it caused, like, a continuity error when they would air that cartoon.
Oh, no.
It would jump.
So, like, he was, like, talking to number 5, and, like, next thing
you know, it would just cut to another scene.
Yeah.
But so I was, like, obsessed with Disney, obsessed with Warner Brothers cartoons. On Saturday mornings, I would wake up before the Saturday morning cartoons. Uh-huh. It's so weird to me.
So you watch, like, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood? Or
I would wake up because before, like, the network would show their cartoons,
right.
The local station would show Rocky and Bullwinkle,
and
Bullwinkle.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would, like, wake up, and it would still be, like, the test signal, and it would be dark outside. But I was so obsessed with – I thought that cartoon was so fun. I still think that cartoon's hilarious. Actually, it feels weird. I'm 37 years old, and I realize, like, when I talk about Saturday morning cartoons, it's a defunct concept. I don't know when it stopped. I think some point in the 90s.
I think it started peter out, like, when I was getting towards the end of my Saturday morning cartooning.
Yeah.
Because I feel like they started becoming live action. And then, like,
it's not even, like, because there's Cartoon Network and other things like that, there's not even a block on the networks where they show Saturday morning cartoons.
Right, anymore. It's, like, now, like, paid stuff. Like, yeah.
But to me, like, that was the thing. And I know if you'd asked me as a little kid, would you rather have 24 hours, 7 days a week of cartoons, I would have gone with that. But it's one of those things, looking back, that, like, it was a really special thing.
Oh, yeah,
like,
of course.
Wake up, and there was, like, you had a few hours. Like, it made you get up on Saturday morning.
Yeah, it made
morning.
You wake up, like, 8 a.m. or whatever.
So it was a super smart thing, actually. It keeps every kid from, like, just sleeping till 10.
I agree.
I would have slept till 10.
Yeah, I mean, I have distinct memories of, like, watching Animaniacs or, like, Tiny Toons. Right. And my mom, like, being, like waking up. My parents are waking up, and I was up before them.
Yeah.
Excuse me, just watching, like, Reboot is, like, a show that really meant a lot to me.
Yeah. Like, my dad, he hosted the show, and he was also the weatherman, and then he got out of television. He worked at a TV station for, like, 10 or 15 years, and he got out of it at a point when corporations started, like buying up, like, local affiliates, and there was this big company that came in, bought the station. He kind of saw the writing on the wall, like, this is not going to be a good place to work anymore. And one of the things that they did when they came in was they said, we're going to cancel we don't need this kid's show anymore.
Yeah.
And they were super excited because they were able to get, they had just decided to syndicate the TV show Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And it was right at the height of, like, Dallas's popularity. But they canceled Showtime and they replaced it with Dallas. And it was shortly after that, for lovers of TV trivia history, that Dallas had its notorious cliffhanger
with
Patrick Duffy, who had died, like, a year or two earlier.
Right.
And it was like
came back, right?
And then the cliffhanger was his wife opens the shower door and he says, good morning. And you're like, oh my God, how is he back from the dead?
Right.
And then it turned out that the way they solved it was the entire season since he died had been a dream.
Oh.
And the whole season, just like any season of a TV show, it had subplots and
multiple. Yeah, it was kind of like, it was kind of like Lost at the end.
Yeah, like any TV show would be like a season of ER or Grey's Anatomy being a dream. Like, one character dreamed plot lines every, like, and nothing surreal happened. It was just my dad's kid's show got replaced right at the point where Dallas's popularity then plummeted. No one was interested in watching it because it's like, oh, you can just make a whole season that we just watched exist.
Yeah.
But so that was really, like, anyway, that was a long tangent for, like, immersed in old radio comedy. Like, it sometimes makes me feel old how many of the things as a little kid I liked that were older than, like, I would listen to old-time radio shows like Jack Benny and stuff
God. Yeah, I love that stuff.
And I don't know that there was any other kids in my school that were listening to that. Like, I wasn't obsessed until later with the things that were current. Like, I was like, like other kids that might have been into, like, whatever the comedy of the day was.
Right.
I was listening to stuff from, like, the 40s and 50s, you know, and 60s.
That's cool, though. I mean, it definitely shows up during your comedy how it's, like, kind of, like, very, how it's very timeless.
I think so, yeah. But then, you know, as I went along, that was, like, as a little kid, those were my influences. Once I became, like, once I was, like, in junior high and high school, I think it probably reads like a predictable sort of list of a certain kind of, like, Woody Allen. Like,
right.
I became obsessed with the movies of Woody Allen, Albert Brooks, when I was in grade school, Weird Al Yankovic was a big influence. And SCTV.
You're making me want to rewatch SCTV. Like, I watched it, like, when they put it on DVD at first, and I was
It holds up so well, I think. I know some people have looked at it and think it does. I just think it really holds up. And because the whole style of that, like, there's stuff, you watch old Saturday Night Lives, and Saturday Night Lives is a very of-the-moment kind of show. And people always vilify Saturday Night Live in the present and glorify it in the past. And it really always is, like, this amazing blend of stuff that works and stuff that doesn't.
Right. Like, there's
the worst season has great stuff and the best season has terrible stuff, you know?
Like, I don't know if you didn't know this, I'm watching all SNL, like, in order because it's all on Netflix.
Yeah.
And I'm on season 14 right now.
Yeah.
Where it's Mike Myers, like, first full season and stuff like that. And there was a sketch called Lyle the Effeminate Heterosexual.
Right.
Where Dana Carvey plays, like, absurdly gay man, but is, like, a normal man.
Right.
By a normal man, I mean, like, a normal...
Like a heterosexual. Like, normal heterosexual,
like, with children and everything.
Yeah,
It's, like, so weird how that is, like... Like, that's that character type is still around.
Right.
To a certain extent, but it's still, like, weird because it's, of course, like, absurdly dated.
Right.
And I agree. Like, it's so weird watching all
it's, it's strange because it's strange to watch an old Saturday Night Live and see a sketch with Bill Murray in it that is not good and is, like, 12 minutes long.
Yeah.
Because no one thinks of that about the first 5 years.
The first 5 years, I'd say half of it's terrible.
Yeah. And that's just the nature.
That's being kind to
and
it, that, too.
And, I mean, well, and some of those things on Netflix are weird because there'll be some episodes that'll be like, they'll have 28 minutes of it on Netflix just because of, I assume, legal issues or, you know, whatever. I have a real strong opinion about Saturday Night Live, though, which is that Saturday Night Live is a show that people love. People in comedy have opinions about everything in comedy.
Of course.
But even people who are a million miles removed from, like, working in comedy or doing comedy, like, Saturday Night Live is a show that everybody feels, like, a sense of ownership to. Like, everybody has an opinion.
Well, because it's been around for, like, five generations now, probably.
Yeah, which on one hand is great, but on the other hand, an opinion that I have, like, such a low tolerance for is you'll commonly hear people say, like, a couple of things. They'll say either, that show needs better writers, or they should cancel that show. Mm-hmm. And my feeling always is, no, they should, in fact, never cancel that show as long as shows are things that are broadcast.
Yeah.
Because what would you replace it with? Like, what are you going to, like, what's so great that you're going to put it on Saturday nights at 11:30
to 1 a.m.?
Yeah. What, I mean, there's a million other channels if you don't like it. Do something else. But especially, why would you cancel 90 minutes of live comedy and music that is on network TV? Like, it's a format that should just, like, it should always happen.
Right.
Until people stop watching TV shows that way completely. Because it's an amazing thing. Like, I remember, well, I guess when I was in junior high, that's when I was discovering, like, Monty Python, Saturday Night Live. There's a certain age where I think you click in, maybe, I'm sure it's younger now, but for me, like, 7th or 8th grade, that was when I was, like, starting to watch things that felt like, it's the right age to discover them, but partly because it feels like it's the wrong age. Like, when you're watching Monty Python in, like, 7th or 8th grade,
you feel kind of like a badass.
Yeah, you feel like, I'm not supposed to be seeing this. Like, this is dealing with, like, sex and politics and culture
weird and weird violence.
Yeah, like things that you're not supposed to be versed in. Like, you know, this isn't, you feel like it's not for teenagers, even though, like, it is actually, like, that's what's great about it. There's actually a part of me that, like, I have a knee-jerk reaction against, like, stuff like, even though I know, I've never seen it, so I'm speaking without any knowledge, but, like, Spamalot or things like that.
Oh, I love I saw Spamalot the second performance, like, the first performance after opening night, and
I've never heard a bad thing about it,
yeah.
But I have a thing about it, which is, like, for me, it's so popular in a way that, like, it takes away that dirty, forbidden aspect of Python.
Yeah, yeah.
Because now, like, everyone's grandma goes to see Spamalot.
Well, the funny thing is, like, because if they were musicalize any Monty Python movie, that's the one that they could easily do it, I'd say, the most.
Right.
Because, like, Meaning of Life, it's just sex jokes.
Right.
Which is nothing wrong with that.
It's also already kind of, like, it'd be hard to top how musical Meaning of Life already is. With
exactly. Like, like, Every Sperm is Sacred.
And Life of Brian would just be picketed.
And I think that's really it for the ones that they would possibly be able to turn into a movie.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, because, like...
Well, like, Mel Brooks is talking about doing, I guess, Blazing Saddles was going to be the next thing.
Right,
that's gonna
be musical. But Young Frankenstein was kind of a flop, which is sad, because I actually enjoyed that show a lot.
Yeah. And I'm speaking with no knowledge of them. All I've ever heard about them is, like, this people love Spamalot. But for me, like, I don't think I'd be able to, and this is even as someone who likes musical theater.
Right.
Like, good musical theater. But for me, it's such a precious thing. That discovery of, like, the show, even the Monty Python's Flying Circus, like, catching, like, old reruns of that, it was like MTV would sometimes run it, like, late at night on the weekends or something.
Right, yeah.
And you catch an old episode in this, and it, like, didn't look like anything I'd ever seen before. Like, Terry Gilliam's animation is so...
It's still so grimy. Weird.
Yeah, like, it's like, it really feels forbidden.
And, like, the fact that it's really crude looking, too, which is
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Like, I was... what was I thinking of for a second there? But, like, yeah, I feel like you have to discover, like, Monty Python when it's, like, the right time.
Yeah.
And, like, it's funny because
I feel like there's a point where it's almost too late. Like, I feel like there'd be a point where you'd like it, but you'd feel like, oh, I wish I'd discovered this 10 years
earlier. Yeah, yeah. Like, for instance, Arrested Development. I was, like, a sophomore in high school when it started. Sophomore, junior in high school, which is, I didn't, like, get into it immediately, but, like, it clicked, like, once the second season happened.
Right.
And now every year, like, every February, I'm in the middle of right now watching the whole series.
Yeah.
And just make sure, and it's still fresh, and still relevant, and it's still hilarious.
That's my favorite thing ever. I mean, I know that's hardly an original opinion to have.
Especially about Arrested Development, yeah, which is,
But that show is so sacred to me. It's like, I genuinely, as a non-religious person, when that show was on the air, I felt like when that show would air on Sunday evenings, it was, like, sacred. It was, like, church to me. And I would watch the episode, and then I would immediately, the second the episode was over, I would watch it again.
Yeah.
And
you would record it, I guess?
And Yeah. And then I would go online, I would just be seeing, like, what jokes did I miss? Like, because there would always
there's
be...
so many... I caught jokes recently that I've never caught before.
Yeah, I just caught I had a joke pointed out to me recently that I never caught, which is in the season 2 episode, the one where they build a house.
Yeah.
That's the title, the one where they build a house.
It's like a Friends episode.
Had like the first 2 episodes were kind of like originally that Friends name advice, and then the third episode of season 2 was called Amigos.
Yeah,
Friends.
Yeah.
There's the part where they have the whole rock, paper, scissors.
Right, in there. Yeah, yeah.
And then Ron Howard says, and it was all covered by the paper. And I didn't get that was a reference to paper covering rock until literally this year. Just because they're so dense. But, like, that was, yeah, I mean, I'd say it was probably too late for it to in any way be an influence on me comedically. I think it was already.
I mean, that type of humor is what I think of as Conor Ratliff humor, too.
Yeah, I watched the first episode of that just because I saw, David Cross and Jason Bateman. I'd always liked Jason Bateman on shows growing up, like I would watch like Silver Spoons and stuff like that. And from a very young age, he was always an actor that I liked that I never felt like – I always felt like he was one of those actors that was never in something that was as good as I thought he was.
Okay, that's fair.
And so I always thought he was funny, but it wasn't always in stuff that you'd look back and say, oh, that was a great show.
Right.
And the first episode of that, I remember watching it and being like 10 minutes in, I'm like, this is really good. And it was kind of before it had been like known as a really good thing. And for me, the breakthrough at the end of that first season when there's the reveal the Saddam Hussein reveal.
Yeah.
That I don't think I'd ever seen that on a comedy before.
Yeah.
Like, you just didn't know
that the show has really real stakes.
That they had like built in all these jokes through the season. Like, there's a joke about how he committed treason, and then there are these Saddam Hussein references all through the season. And you're like, oh, wow, they've been planting these, like, planting jokes early on. It was just, like, amazing. Like, now shows, like, that's something that happens
in comedy. Right, like Breaking Bad, they've been, like, setting up everything from the first episode.
Well, it's something that, like, dramas would do that maybe before.
Right.
But never like, comedy. Like,
Raising Hope does that, I've noticed.
Yeah?
I don't know if you watch it or not.
I haven't seen Raising Hope, no, but they'll, like, plant, like...
But, like, there's definitely, like, things that are, like, that they don't forget about.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, oh, that's weird. Like, oh, it comes back later.
Yeah.
I can't think of an example right now. My brain is not working right now, apparently, but...
But they're, like, yeah,
do it's
like
one of those shows that, like, oh, you know?
Yeah. But so, like, I mean, when I was in, like, I started acting when I was, like, 10. Actually, you can see, if you look on YouTube... There's an episode of my dad's TV show where I'm promoting the first play I ever did. Because I grew up wanting to be a cartoonist.
Right.
As a little kid, I wanted to be an animator. And then I realized at a certain point that I would, even if I became good enough to be an animator, it wouldn't be fun for me. Because I started to realize, like, oh, that kind of means that you're working in a factory, sort of. You're
right, yeah, especially even back then, like when it was all just people like just drawing and like.
I wanted to make cartoons, but like becoming an animator wasn't necessarily a path toward making cartoons. Like I wanted to think of cartoons and then make those cartoons, you know. And then I tried out for a local production of Oliver.
Yeah, were you Oliver?
No, I was an orphan.
Yeah.
I wasn't a good enough dancer to be one of the... I was an orphan in the orphanage at the beginning.
Right.
I wasn't a good enough dancer to be one of the pickpocket, one of Fagin's kids. So I was a chimney sweep in one of the big musical numbers, and then I had a line in a scene where I was like the kid who, I came by, and I said like,
Bill Sykes is coming.
No, I said like, my line was, here's the books you ordered from the bookseller.
Oh, that's such a great one line, character line.
Yeah, and I, you can hear the Cockney accent that I did at the time, which sounds like, the Cockney accent I did was like, here's the books you ordered from the bookseller, sir, and... But in my defense, if you see the older kids who had played like Oliver and the Artful Dodger, I was copying their accents.
Nice.
So like I actually did a pretty decent job. Like I was, they were kind of not, didn't quite have a
Cockney
accent. So I had an equally inaccurate.
It's close to Cockney what you were doing there. I mean, it's definitely a British accent.
Yeah, but it was, but so like I did that play, and then I started doing like local community theater plays and plays in school, and then at a certain point, I decided that I would, that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. What was like the, like, what were some like your best plays that you did in school and locally?
Well, I was in a local group that we put on, I was in Brighton Beach Memoirs. That was the first role. I played Eugene in Brighton Beach Memoirs.
That's a great role for you. I could totally see
main role in it. And then, I was part of a group that we put on Shakespeare in the Park for free every summer.
Cool.
And we were kind of like fed up with the local community theater group. So we just like formed, it was like me and some guys in their 20s who I'd been in plays with. And we formed this group and my parents were involved in it. And we would put on these free Shakespeare plays every summer. And so we did like Midsummer Night's Dream and Twelfth Night and Taming of the Shrew and stuff like that. And then I was in a production. I tried out for a professional, I grew up in Jefferson City, Missouri.
Right. Which, that's interesting.
Yeah, state capital. That most people, if they know the name of it, it's because they've learned all the state capitals.
It's like one of the smaller state capitals.
Yeah, it's like a medium-sized small town. And I ended up going for 2 years to as a theater major at the University of Missouri-Columbia, which is like a half hour away. And I went there mainly because it was close and because when I was in high school, I went and auditioned for the, they had a professional summer repertory theater in the summer that would be like a, you'd get paid to, it would be like your summer job. And I got cast in the main role in the play of Ordinary People.
Oh, cool.
And so like that was my summer job. That meant that I didn't have to do another thing that summer, which was great. And I actually was in that, this would have been 1993.
Mm-hmm.
1992. I was in that play through the summer. And then they said they wanted to continue it as the first play of the school year.
Oh, cool.
Because I think sometimes they did that so that they could have a play
that
was already rehearsed. But the actor who played the Judd Hirsch role, that's the role of the therapist,
right,
wasn't available for those 2 weeks. So they cast a student who was a theater major, who was a senior at the time, to play the therapist.
Oh, cool.
And that was John Hamm.
That's cool.
So for two
weeks, I thought it was Kansas. For some reason, I thought it was Kansas. But that's awesome.
Yeah. So I mean, that was great. And I went there when I graduated school. I went there for a couple of years, and then there was a point where even though I was a theater major at MU and I did pretty well my first year, got some parts in plays, and when you're a theater, when you're on a theater scholarship, As a theater major, you're required to audition for all of the plays. Like that's
right.
One of the terms
scholarship. Yeah, that's why I was required with my, I didn't get a scholarship, but at my program I was a BFA.
And so in the second year, something weird happened that I never got an answer on, which was I stopped being cast in any plays, and I hadn't done anything wrong, and they were like directors that had worked with me before and things had gone well. But some weird thing happened that no one ever explained to me what I'd done.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would like audition for a play. I remember I auditioned for a play, and there were three parts for guys in this play, and five guys auditioned for it.
Oh, that's
the
worst.
And they called four people to callbacks.
Oh.
And literally one of the five guys could barely read words off a page, like let alone act.
Oh, God, I've had that happen before.
And literally, like, the guy who was directing the play, I wasn't wrong for any of the parts, the guy who was directing the play, I was in an acting class that he was teaching at the same time that he gave me, like, over 100% on a subjectively graded class. Like, he gave me 100% grade for the acting class, and I'd done, like, an extra acting assignment that I'd gotten this bonus credit for. So I literally had, like, 104% in a class where if he didn't like me, he could have given me a B. Like, he could have. So I'm like, this guy clearly, like, doesn't have a problem with me, but I'm not being cast. And then there was another, then the final straw for me was they did a production of The Rover by Afra Bean, which is like a Shakespearean era play.
Right, yeah.
And like Shakespeare plays, it has literally, like 20 plus role, speaking roles for guys. So they were just like starving for guy parts. Yeah. And this was a director I'd worked with before. And literally, I was the only person I knew who didn't get cast in this play. So I just decided, I'm done here. Like, I don't even care what the answer is. Like, I haven't done anything wrong. I'm not hard to work with, but it didn't matter to me what the answer was. I'm like, I'm going somewhere else.
So you transferred schools?
Well, at that point, I was sort of a spite move. I was too late. This was like February of the
senior year?
Sophomore year.
Sophomore year.
And it was too late to apply places. Like, I would have to, like, I wouldn't be able to get in the fall.
You'd have to wait until.
So I would have had to skip a semester, and I didn't want to do that. And I saw an ad in USA Today. Not an ad. It was just a little side article saying Elvis Costello is going to be teaching at a new school in Liverpool that Paul McCartney is opening up.
That's so cool.
He's going to be teaching songwriting, and I'm a... an obsessive Elvis Costello fan. Other obsessive Elvis Costello fans, if they ever visited a website between 1995 and 2008 called Bright Blue Times, I ran an Elvis Costello website until I got to the point where I'm like, I should not be doing this anymore. but I literally wrote off to the address just because I was curious, like, what's he? Let me get a brochure.
Yeah.
I didn't know. And then when I, because they said they were looking for America, they wanted me to make it an international school, and they were looking for Americans to apply. And when I got the brochure, it was really cool because it was a brand new school that was opening up that was going to be focusing on actually practically working in the entertainment industry. And it was a 3-year bachelor's degree because in England, you don't do general ed stuff when you go to college because their school system's better, so they've already taught you general education stuff in public school. And so. So you don't have to spend 4 years to get your bachelor's degree.
You used to have 3 in.
And you just focus on your major, basically. And so when I got the brochure, I thought, this looks really cool. And they have an acting program, and it was 3 years. And in the third year, one of the things was, like, you design your own, like, final year. Like, you design your final project or whatever.
Wow.
And so I thought it sounded really good. So I thought, well, I'll just write off and get an audition for this. So I got an audition, I flew to New York, I auditioned for the school, and I got in. And it was all I was in a mode of, like, I'm going to find someplace great to go to since I'm not being treated well here. And then, like, by the time I got in, I was sort of like, what have I done? Like, why did I do this? Well, I could have just, like, stayed near my home and stuffed it up, you know? Instead of flying to this strange country... This depressed northern British...
Right, because Liverpool is
like
the most like down and out.
The most down and out, but it's definitely like there are
it's
a lot of
working class.
There are a lot of great things about Liverpool, but when I got there, certainly my initial impression was like, this is a shipping town that no longer is a hub for shipping. Like the town has time sort of passed it by and is trying to figure out what it's going to be now. And I went to school there for 3 years, and I mean, initially it was terrifying because, like, my impression of what the Beatles sounded like in cartoons even was what I thought Liverpool would be like. Hey, how are you? Oh, hello. You know, very like, I thought everybody would be very, oh, yes, come over here and we'll have, you know, be really nice, you know. And in truth, there's a kind of Liverpool, well, they call them Scouse or Scousers.
Okay.
A Scouser is a Liverpudlian. And there's a certain kind of people who've been or who are from Liverpool know what I'm talking about. I'm not meaning to besmirch. There are lots of great kids in Liverpool, but there's a certain kind of kid in Liverpool who roams around the city center
Wes is like, hey, what are you doing? Hey, fuck you, mate. I'm gonna go over and fuck you in a minute.
Like, they really have, like, this...
Oh, God. Like,
literally, that's the thing. It's been hardcore, and they have this, like, really aggressive nature. And so it was, like, really terrifying to go over there at first. I never fully got... I got mugged within a few months of being there, and I never fully, like, got comfortable in Liverpool. I always had a feeling of, like, ugh. One time I was talking to my mom on a international calling card on a payphone in the Liverpool City Center on a Sunday afternoon. And a lot of stores were closed on Sunday at that time. And a bunch of, like, 7 or 8 year olds surrounded me. This wasn't when I got mugged. This was after I'd been mugged already.
Oh, no.
And I was on the phone to my mom. And I remember saying to my mom, like, I gotta go. And I was just like, please don't let me get mugged by children while I'm on the phone to my mom.
Oh,
God. Like, it just felt horrible because they were just, like, staring at me. And they had every advantage. They were little, but there were so many of them. Like, I can't fight off this many kids.
Did they have, like, weapons with them?
Or I don't know, just... but that's the thing. Like, if they had little knives in their pockets or something.
Well, like, I mean, like, do they have, like, a chain, like, out? Like,
no, they had nothing out, but they had, like, track suits and hands in their pockets and stuff. God. So you never know, like...
No, if they had, like, brass knuckles.
Butter knives, that would have been a problem. Yeah.
Oh, God. Continue.
So, my thinking was that going to a brand new school that was, like, they were putting all this money into it, and Paul McCartney had attached his name to it.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
I thought, well, if their first year's graduating class doesn't do well, doesn't go out and get jobs, like, that kind of kills the school. So this school's really going to be pushing to help out its first year class.
That makes sense, yeah.
Which is exactly what happened. Like, I got an agent straight out of school and...
Were you, like, in England still?
In England, yeah. Okay. I have dual citizenship because my mom's from Ireland.
Right,
so, yeah.
How long were you living in England for?
I lived in England for 5 years total. I worked in London as an actor for a couple of years.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and...
that's really cool. I mean, because, like, that means you've had, like, the full perspective of, like, British acting and, like, American
acting. I also had the perspective of what it was like, at least at University of Missouri Columbia, what it was like taking acting classes in an American university as opposed to a British approach.
Right.
It's very different.
Yeah.
It's hard to put my finger on it, but this is different.
I feel like the character work is the main difference. From an American standpoint, because I've never been to England to see shows, but I've seen like Mary Stuart that was in the West End and stuff like that.
Yeah,
like those shows that were intact brought over to America, and it's just I feel like the character work and movement based stuff is a little bit more intense.
Yeah, I mean I never liked acting classes, to be honest. I never liked them. I always felt like I only learned about acting from just doing plays.
I feel like I've learned most from acting from just doing plays and doing improv. Like mainly in moment to moment stuff.
Yeah. Acting, I actually hated being an actor. Even though like I had a reasonable amount of success, like for not doing it that long. Like I really went at it for a couple years in England. But I just didn't like it. I got to a point where like I was going out for auditions and I would throw auditions for things that I didn't want to do. Rather than tell my agent I don't want to go out for it, I was too nervous to tell my agent, like, don't put me out, because I thought then they would stop putting me out for things. But, like, if I read the play and I didn't like it, then I would go in and I would try to strategically think, how can I do a good audition where they'll like me as an actor but think I'm wrong for the role?
Oh.
Which is kind of became a game, almost, where I would think, like...
Well, that's interesting.
What kind of actor could I be where they'd think of me for something else but not for this?
So you would go out for, like, Iago and Othello, but, like, kind of come off like a nice guy?
No, not that. I mean, I was almost exclusively going up for American roles, which I kind of was, like... That was it. I would go up for less things, but when I was up for something, it would be me up against a handful of maybe a couple of other... like, expatriate Americans or something, and mostly, like, British people doing an American accent, so I'd have this advantage going in. But I kind of felt like, I mean, I can do a British accent, but it's such a disadvantage going up against actual British actors.
Exactly.
Like, there's just no reason. I wouldn't cast me if I'd had an equally good...
I get terrified when I do a British accent with, like, a British person in the room, because...
Accents are more precise in England. Like, in America, everyone kind of... Like, there are some precise accents.
Yeah, yeah.
But everyone moves around a lot more, and you get your accent influenced by television.
Right.
In ways that doesn't happen in England. Like, in England, if you're from you know,
from Liverpool, you have a distinct Liverpool accent.
Liverpool, if you're from the suburbs in Liverpool, yeah. If you're from Manchester, you're an hour away, but you sound completely different. You know,
like,
and they know the difference. Like, they know if you're blending them. Whereas when British actors I was in school with, when they would, like, do their American accents, a lot of times I'd be like, yeah, I mean, it sounds a little weird, but I've heard people talk like that.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, like, there isn't one.
It's like they do like a very generic American, but like it's kind of like an American.
But it's fine. Like, it's like not wrong because there's less precision to it.
I mean, it's like the same thing as an American doing a British accent, just a generic British accent. Like, yeah, yeah, it's right, but it's just not like it doesn't have a home.
Yeah, and then me deciding to stop acting coincided with just like a thing I've talked about before, which I'll give the short version of, which was that. I got cast in a little part in Band of Brothers.
I heard about that for the first time today from Rudy Behrens. But yeah.
Yeah, and I got cast. I auditioned for him a bunch of times just for a tiny little part in episode 5. But I had to audition like multiple times. At this point, I had moved back up to Liverpool.
Yeah.
And I was commuting for auditions down to London. So it was like a 3.5-hour train ride.
Yeah.
Do an audition and then get back on a train. And I auditioned a bunch of times, and I finally got to the point where they were like, you're the only person we're looking at for this one part. And then they cast me in the part, and they fit me for my costume, they cut my hair, and then I found out that Tom Hanks would be directing my episode, so I was super excited
about
that.
Yeah, that's pretty insane.
And because I'd written and acted in this independent movie called Living in Missouri it was being finished at that point. And one of the actors who was in that movie was, like, an old friend of Tom Hanks. So I had this, like, in my back pocket, I thought, like, oh, this would be great. If I ever have to have a conversation, I have an actual thing.
Yeah, and not
talk
like,
to
like,
hey, you know.
Not like, I liked you in Forrest Gump.
Yeah. And so what happened was the day before I was supposed to film my scenes, I get a call from my agent saying, Tom Hanks has looked at your audition tape. And he's having second thoughts.
Oh.
Now, it's probably the first time he'd looked at it, because I think other people cast me.
Of course, yeah.
He was making Castaway, I think, at the time when they were gearing up for
that. Right, yeah.
And so they're like, you have to come down here right now and read for him. And the thing that was hard about it was literally like a very small, like, 3-line part, and there was no meat on the bone. It wasn't the kind of part.
It was just like, they're over there.
I was the tea boy, basically, who I come and say, sir, would you like any coffee or tea? And I'd say, okay, sir, well, I'll be out in the hallway if you need me, sir. Thank you, sir.
Like, that was like, it's literally
so
just,
I didn't have, like, a monologue where I could be like, they killed him. Yeah, it was nothing where I could,
like
really
truly
show
acting chops.
Yeah. Like, the best acting I could do would seem like, oh, he's not doing anything. Like, I wouldn't remember him.
Which is exactly what that role would require.
So I went in, I read for him, and then they said, they've decided to go another way. They've decided to go with a more military type, which made no sense to me. I know that wasn't true because there was a draft during World War II, and it wasn't like I was the one who, like, took, you know, like, I wasn't raising the flag at Iwo Jima. I was offering coffee and
tea. Yeah, you were the guy that they have on the radio.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think it probably just was my assumption has always been that he arrived to direct his episode and probably just legitimately didn't like the look of me on the tape and decided, oh, this is a part I can recast. You know,
okay. Well, I mean,
the only thing I didn't like about that, the only thing that I object to is, the thing I heard was that, what my agent said was that when he looked at my tape, he said that I had dead eyes.
I would never describe you as dead-eyed.
I have seen it before. I've seen what he's talking about. I actually am willing to fully acknowledge that I might have had dead eyes. I have seen myself on camera, not always, but occasionally I have seen things where I'm like, oh, that's probably what I look like on that tape. The only thing I object to is, you know, I've heard things where Tom Hanks, as an actor, has talked about how he doesn't like coming back to New York, for instance, because he it reminds him of the struggle of when he was starting out as an actor. The
well,
only thing
he's
I objected
be in New York
to
very soon, so
the only thing I objected to was I do think that, like, you know, you got to make the decisions you got to make.
Yeah.
But I think there's a way that you can do these things, even if the person still ends up being pissed off at you. There's a way to do it that's not shitty. You know, there's a way to do it where it's don't pretend that I'm auditioning for a part that you're firing me from.
Exactly.
That was my only objection. Was if he'd said, like, we're going to go another way, and he'd said it to me, I would have felt better than pretending that I was auditioning for a part that I'd already been cast.
And like, preparing for
it. And I was paid for it, but I would have gladly given up the money just to do the work.
Of like, course,
I would rather have done that.
So what got you into doing improv then?
Well, I stopped acting because I got to that point. That was sort of like just, that wasn't what made me stop, but that was sort of at the point where I was like, I don't like doing this. Like, this isn't, like, it kept getting further and further from what I liked about acting. And so I moved to New York, and I lived in Oregon for a couple of years, and I worked at my best friend from who I'd known since seventh grade was running a preschool, and I lived in Ashland, Oregon for 2 years, and I helped him out at his preschool.
That's so cool.
And I just at that time I was working on this getting this independent film into festivals.
Right.
We had some luck getting into festivals, but we had really bad luck with the timing. Like, We had applied in all these festivals, and we finally got it into the Austin Film Festival, which is a major one.
Yeah.
And felt great for me because I'd written the film, and their focus is on screenwriting.
Yeah.
And I felt like this will be great because industry comes to Austin, and they are having a fun time. It's a great place for them to see your film. We got accepted into the Austin Film Festival in August of 2001
mm-hmm.
for early October 2001. So History Bus will note that that might have been the worst time to be expecting Hollywood people to fly an airplane from L.A. to Austin for fun.
Yeah.
It was just after they'd stopped grounding all air traffic in the wake of 9/11.
So it was early October.
It was during the anthrax attacks. So it was just like...
I almost forgot about the anthrax. That's insane.
Yeah, so it was just... It really felt like the world was falling apart, and there was just nobody went to Austin who didn't have a film. So... it was fun, but, like, it did us no good. Then we got a review in Variety, I think, at one point, which was a really positive review, except for the opening paragraph, which basically said, this movie has no potential for distribution. So it basically...
It was like a mumblecore before mumblecore?
It wasn't mumblecore, but it was basically a movie about two childhood best friends who really should no longer be best friends but still were out of kind of atrophy.
Okay.
And my character was a deeply unpleasant adult Star Wars nerd who was married with kids but just ran his Star Wars website and took it. So it was based on there was kind of this thing in the 90s of movies about, like, charming nerds who
made,
like, funny observations.
Like, and the Dollar Steve.
Or, like, Clerks. Chasing Amy. They always were, like they'd be imbued with, or even, like, the Tarantino characters were always so funny and witty in the way they talk about pop culture. And the character that I wrote for myself was based on my observation that there was another kind of nerd that hadn't been as well documented in pop culture at that point, which was deeply unpleasant and humorless and not witty at all.
Oh, God.
And that was the character that I was playing. All he wanted to do was basically be single again. And his best friend was this lonely single guy who lived in his parents' basement. And they basically wanted to be one another for him.
Yeah,
yeah. But my character was just horribly abusive to his best friend. Just, like, used him as a lackey, sort of. And so it was, like, a dark comedy drama. I can't really watch it now.
Yeah, I understand that.
So, like, I haven't shown it to anybody in a long time because it feels so far removed from anything I'm doing now.
I
think it was good. I just am personally, I'm like at a point where
it's not relevant anymore to you.
Yeah. And so when I was in Oregon, I was kind of focusing on that, but, you know, it wasn't really going anywhere. You know, we'd have luck, but then, like, the Variety review was a great stroke of luck, but, like, nobody who would be in a position to give us chances would read past that first paragraph saying, like, hey, Hollywood, don't read this review. It doesn't matter.
Read everything but the first paragraph?
Right. If you eliminated that first paragraph, we probably would have gotten some interest from people saying, we heard you had a good movie.
Yeah. But the first paragraph was like, this
first paragraph was just like, don't bother reading about this film. It's not going to be part of show business.
Okay.
So then I moved to New York in 2002, and for a brief period of time, I tried becoming an actor again.
And
what I found was, like, I'd put on a play or something, and it was just impossible getting people to come see it.
It's
and
really
it was a lot
hard.
Of work, and it just was no fun. And, like, even, like, my old contacts, like, I did one of those workshops where, like, you meet a casting director and he talks to you about it, and then he auditions.
Yeah, I've done that several times.
And The casting director had actually looked at like some of my credits from London, and he was like, "Oh, I can't. Like, why are you doing this workshop?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Oh, here, you should like talk to this agent." And he was like, "It was almost as if he was saying like, this workshop is a scam."
Yeah.
But oh, you're an actual actor or something. Yeah. It was like a weird feeling. And but then like I met with that agent, and the agent was like, disinterested. Like it just felt like this is a big uphill climb for something I'm not sure I want to do. And so I kind of just lived in New York for a number of years and didn't do anything. And then I think it was 2008. A friend of mine was dating someone at UCB, and she asked me, like, "Hey, let's go see, he's got this show on." And I'd heard of UCB, and I knew what it was, and I knew who Amy Poehler was and everything, but I just kind of always assumed that, like, it would be, my assumption was that the world of comedy, like, I'd like to do it, but I thought it would just be poisonous, kind of. I felt like, it'll just be like a bitter, poisonous place.
I agree. Like, I felt like that, too, before I got into the world. Because improv is a lot different than comedy.
Yeah. And I really felt like, I'm fine. I don't need to do this. And then I went and I saw a show there, and I was like, this theater's pretty amazing. And I, very naively at the time, I was like, how does someone put a show up here? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, of course.
And I was told, like, oh, you want to take classes? And at this point, I was 27, 28, that's only like 29 maybe. No, I would have been older than that. I was like 32.
Okay.
Yeah, 32. And I remember the time being told, like, you'll take classes. I was like, take classes? I'm in my 30s.
Yeah,
like,
I'm
done taking classes. And then I started seeing some more things at UCB, and like, this is great. And, you know, my problem, like, I don't go see plays a lot.
Yeah.
And people always, it's a weird personal thing I have, because I know lots of people who love going to see plays, and I have three reactions to plays. I either go to a play and it's great, and I just spend the whole play thinking, like, I want to be up on stage doing this.
Oh, God, I've had that or so many times recently. Continue.
A bad play is, like, the worst thing in the world. I can watch a bad movie,
I've seen my fair share of bad plays.
I can see bad improv shows, even.
Yeah.
But a bad play, it's like, you worked on this. Like, and I also feel like a bad movie is like, it's done, and you're just watching it. But a bad play, I always have this feeling like, we could stop this. Like, we, the audience, could stand up. Like, we're letting this happen. I always feel like vaguely complicit.
Yeah.
But the other thing I had is, like, I remember when there was that production of Glengarry Glen Ross a few years back.
Yeah,
that
with Liam Schreiber.
And Jeffrey Tambor. Yeah, yeah. And
great people.
Alan Alda was in.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just like some of my favorite actors. And I was like, I want to go see it, but I can't. I won't enjoy it if I have to spend $100 to go see it. I won't enjoy it. Even if I spend $50 to go see it, I'll feel like I'm riding around in a cab the whole time.
Oh, God.
Because if I don't like it, then I just feel like, too big a hit, you know. I don't, because knowing that my positive and negative experiences of plays
I really do understand more than you have any idea.
And when I went to UCB, that was one of the things I'm like when I would try to get people to come see a play I was in, I would feel like, why am I asking you to spend $20 to come see this play when you could stay home and watch something that you know is great?
Yeah.
You know, you could stay home and watch a great TV show. You watch The Sopranos or Mad Men or something, you know, whatever was on at whatever time I was doing plays. But at UCB, I was like, these plays are $5 and $10, and they're the best things I've ever seen in New York. And I'm like, I want to perform at a place that's like that.
Yeah.
And so at a certain point, I was just like, okay, I'll take classes. And the thing that was different for me, I had never liked an acting class. Not really. Like, even looking back, like, even classes I thought I liked, I'm like, I didn't really like that class. But the classes at UCB were the first time that I'd taken any kind of, like, creative or performing class where I felt like they were saying things that actually, even the things that didn't make sense to me felt more useful, like things like studying game and things like that. But, like, just useful things that would say, like, oh, if you're going to do a scene like this, like, don't do this, or try not doing this, or try doing that. Like, they felt, like, the rules felt practical. And even the rules are like training wheels rules, like you know.
Even the no rule goes away eventually.
Yeah, like, well, they say, like, don't fight in scenes. And first they'd be like, well, all I want to do is fight. That's
exactly.
Easy to do scenes. And what you realize is it's really just a way of, you can't do that yet because you don't know how to do a scene
exactly.
yet. And like what one thing that is a common thing for me, like when I'm coaching improv, is like I realized early on that there was a certain kind of scene that when new improvisers are doing scenes, they'll do a thing because it feels comfortable because it's replicating natural human behavior.
Yeah.
But they won't be building a scene. So, like, a scene will start off and someone will go, hey. The other person will say, hey. And then they'll say, how you doing? Oh, I'm pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's natural. That happens all the time. That's a real thing. So you trick yourself into thinking that you're doing good improv because it's realistic.
Yeah.
But you're, you know, six lines into a scene and you haven't said anything. You don't know anything. And you realize, like, oh, it was such, like, a short-term solution. It was a short-term fix. And it's actually, you've been going in the wrong direction. And so, like, rules, like, don't fight. Like, initially, you kind of instinctively, I would push back against them. I think, why not fight? Like, a fight could be funny. Like, but then I would realize, like, oh, no. Like, I remember in my 201 class, there was a guy, Tony Mui, who I'm probably saying his wrong.
I know he's M-U-I.
I don't know if I've ever pronounced it in front of him and been corrected. But I remember there was a scene where he was... Someone said something, and then he responded by complimenting the person. And I remember thinking that was really funny. And I was like, I never do that in my scenes. Like, and it was funny to me in the same way that I noticed, like, in the best Owen Wilson performances, his characters tend to enjoy giving and receiving compliments in a way that's, like, surprising.
He's got a lot of love to his characters.
Yeah, like, if someone, like, in the movie Bottle Rocket, if someone compliments the jumpsuits they're wearing, he'd be like, you like these? Well, I'll get you one of these. And it's funny because it's, like, it's a surprising and charming kind of reaction. And, I mean, there's wrong ways to do that. I remember that being kind of like a moment where I'm like, oh, that's what they say, don't fight. It's kind of more interesting if you go along with this. And then later on you realize, like, oh, you can do a scene and start fighting right away, but you have to make sure that it's dynamic in that same way. And so, like, I took classes. I sped through the first four levels. And
how quickly did you get on your first Howl team?
I started in May of 2009.
Okay.
And then I got through 401.
Whoa, you went through fast.
Yeah, so I got through 401.
Oh, my God.
By Christmas of 2009. And then... I spent 2010 doing advanced study
classes.
Right,
and then, because I know Dance Break was your first one?
No, Capture was my first team, and that was January of 2011.
Right.
So, it was basically like...
What was that phone call like then?
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah, I always get curious about that phone call.
I was enrolled in an Anthony... This is when Anthony King was artistic director, and I was enrolled in...
Towards the end of his time.
Yeah, and I was enrolled. I had just signed up for an advanced study performance class that he was teaching. It was going to be my first class with him that was focusing on the Herald. And those classes tended to all be, like, weird forms. Like, I'd done the movie as a class, and you'd have, like Vantage Point or the Avente or the different, you know, and it was usually an unusual form. And in December of 2010, this class went up that was Anthony King, artistic director of UCB, and it was a performance class that was focusing on the Herald. And
was that the Herald After Dark class? I can't remember.
It might have been, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so my thinking, and I think the thinking of at least a couple other people in that class, was like, oh, this is going to be like...
Two Heralds in front of the artistic director.
Yeah, like kind of like boot camp for Heralds in front of the artistic director. Because I had auditioned once when I was in spring of 2010... I auditioned once. I didn't get a call back, but I wasn't expecting one because I just didn't want to, a year later, go in and be like, oh, that's what the auditions are like? I didn't know. I just wanted to see what it was like. And so I didn't get a call back. But a bunch of people that I knew who were like at the same sort of level, who'd gone through class with me, did get callbacks. So I remember feeling kind of like, I kind of wish I got a call back now.
Yeah.
You know, like, I wasn't begrudging them. It was sort of a feeling of like, oh, like, I didn't get one and people I know did, you know. And, but early on, I really made it not important to me to get on a Herald team. Not that I didn't want to, but I was just like, if I'm doing this for that reason, I won't get on. I really was just like, I just want to get good at this. Like, my fear actually was that I would get on and not be ready for it.
That's a big fear of mine, which, I mean, I've not had any opportunity for a callback. I've only had one audition so far for Herald Night.
Right.
And, like, When I went to the audition, I was just like, God, I'm not ready at all. Like, I just got into advanced study, like, two weeks before.
I had that weird feeling about, well, other people get callbacks, but I didn't want to be on Herald Night.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I don't understand how heralds work at all. I just was like, I'm not good enough at this.
Oh, because that's really funny, because, like, I mean, I think of so many great heralds I've watched you do, because I remember, I think it was... Was Mujan on both your Herald teams? Or
she was on Capture.
Right. I remember there was...
She got moved to Ragnarok and then got moved to American Cousin.
Yeah. I remember, like, distinctly, the first time I remember seeing you, like, do that, like, really, like, stuck out to me was you and her were, like, in a hot tub in a scene.
I have no memory of it.
Like, wow. It was just, like, this guy is really fun to watch.
Yeah. I think when Mujan and I were on a team together, I would do most of my scenes with Mujan, I think. You know,
I distinctly remember that. Yeah.
My fear was that I wouldn't be ready for it. But my other thing was I thought, I'm not going to get on through an audition. I really felt like I'm just not going to do the kind of thing in an audition.
Was Capture through an audition?
Or no.
Oh, yeah, because it was January, and the auditions were spring and fall.
So my thing was that the Anthony King class would kind of be like, if I did your work audition in the class, that I'd have 8 weeks of classes and 4 11 o'clock shows on stage. And I thought, like, if Anthony King thinks I'm ready, then I feel like that would... He'll either think I'm ready or I'm not based on this class, and the audition sort of... I feel like maybe it wouldn't matter as much.
Okay.
Because he would have seen that I could do it.
Oh, I understand exactly.
It would have been more than an audition. We'd been getting, like, lots of FaceTime, you know?
Yeah.
But then, before that class... A week before that class even started, I got a... there was a morning when... There started to be people who were getting placed that day. There were a couple of people who had gotten placed. And I remember seeing that Bloodband... I remember seeing on Twitter, I had just gotten a BlackBerry.
Yeah.
So it was my first time I was getting, like, internet on a phone.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember seeing, like, oh, like, Bloodband got put on a team, and Noah Foreman, who I didn't really know at that point, got put on a team.
And you clearly still don't know.
Arthur Meyer put on a team at that point. And I was like, oh, this is exciting. New people on Herald Night. That's exciting. And I was at work, and I would go on the computers at work to make reservations for Herald Night, because you had to do it so fast and before it would sell out. And so I made a reservation for the following week's Herald Night as soon as it went online. That was on, a Wednesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like 11 o'clock or something when it goes. It's 11 on Wednesdays when they go
online. It's like 10 or 11.
10 or 11, yeah. I think it was 11. I don't remember. 10 o'clock, maybe. And I made a reservation for Herald Night, and then, like, 10 or 20 minutes later, my phone buzzed, and it was a number I didn't recognize, so I didn't pick up. And I checked the message, and it was Anthony King wanting me to call him. And I assumed it was something about there was either a problem with the class.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that maybe there was something to do with, like, I want the people in this class to, like, you know...
See the story to, you know, yeah.
I assumed it was something like that. And then I was not expecting at all to be placed on a team. And I called him back and I left a message, and then he called me back and I answered. And he said, hi, Connor, this is Anthony King. How are you? I said, fine. He says, I'm calling because I want to know if you would, I want to offer you, if you would like to be on Herald Night, perform on Herald Night. And I was like, yes. Yes, I would.
Yeah.
And then he said, okay, I'm going to be emailing you, like, some details, and sort of, you know. And so I was just like, still the weirdest detail to me is, because I imagine this isn't a thing that happens much in any circumstances, how many times a person buys a ticket for a show and then finds out they're in that show. I had just reserved a ticket for a show that would happen on Tuesday.
And was your team on that night?
Well, it was still starter names.
Oh, okay.
Because I think they'd switched up some teams or something. And, they'd broken up Monstro and the Opera and those teams. But, like, how often do you, like, buy a ticket for a concert or play and then you get a call saying, like, hey, you want to be in this show that you just bought a ticket for?
Yeah.
And so I was just, you know, really... So then I was like, oh, wow, the next time I go... And they were up first as well. So I'm like, wow, the next time I go into UCB for Herald Night... I will be getting the suggestion for the first team.
Right, because for those who don't know, which we've discussed this several times, the first newest person on Herald Night on the team gets a suggestion.
Yeah.
So then, I want to skip forward now through Herald Night and stuff like that. is it true Gefford is the reason why he got into Stepfathers? Or
well, he's certainly part, a big, huge part of it. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I was on Captcha first, and then Captcha got shuffled up,
and a lot of them became Dance Break.
Like half of it became Dance
Break, which was a great team that I loved. I loved Dance Break a lot,
and I loved being on Dance Break. I love everybody. I loved both teams. Mm-hmm. Like Captcha beat Ruru at Cage Match. It was kind of
I remember that
unlikely thing. But I felt like I sent an email to Captcha the night before we got split up, saying, like, I really think we're becoming a better and better team.
Okay.
And I really did believe it. Like, I think, I just still believe that. I think Captcha is a weird bunch of people, but I think as a team that was getting better and better. But then Dance Break was great. And when, during that time, I was taking a class, Gethard did the parentheses class.
Yeah. Which
the whole point of
the parentheses class
was like 29 people, I think. 28 people. 28 people in the class. And it was just like, let's just figure it out. You know, like, it was just a huge class. It was insane. It was crazy. And then that class was filled with people doing weird, crazy things. And I kind of felt in some ways out of place in that class sometimes because I was just like, I felt like I was just doing, like, fun scene work. Like, other people who have great minds were like, let's break the form open, let's do this, let's run outside. Like, and I would just be like, oh, I'll just enter as a character and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt like, oh, I'm probably a little old-fashioned in this class. Like, I did feel like I'm not edgy or I'm not unusual enough. And when we, toward the end of that class, Gethard, he suggested, like, he said, he asked me if I would be interested in doing some two-prov sets with him, like at the Creek.
Oh, that's so cool.
And I was like stunned, because I was like,
yeah, I mean, Gethard's been a legend, at least somewhat recently.
Yeah. And I had taken a workshop with Gethard at like 2 DCMs earlier. He has no memory of it. But he asked me to, so we did a couple two-prov sets at the Creek, and I, also, that was around the same time that the Chris Gethard show moved from being a stage show to being a public access show. And he asked me if I wanted to contribute, like, short films. So I started doing The Lone Cornmeal Machine with Mael Delaveau, which basically was like, I realized the first week that went up, I'm like, oh, weird. I grew up wanting to make cartoons, and now I've sort of, through this weird roundabout way, I'm like
doing that
making...
On public access.
I wasn't doing the animation because those were things where the way those would work is we get a suggestion on Twitter for like what next week's film would be, and then Mael would do all the visuals. She would do all the footage without me knowing it, give me the finished footage, and then I would edit it and decide what the music and narration or dialogue would be.
Yeah.
So she would write the visual aspect of it, but then I would kind of decide what the visual stuff meant.
Yeah.
So I was, like, doing the part of cartoons that I could do. You know, like, she was doing all the visual, really hard work. And then I would come in and go, like, hey, I'm a bird. And so, like, I was heavily involved. And then I also started doing the presidential campaign on the Gethard Show.
Which is unbelievable, in my personal opinion, just because the simple fact that you lasted so much longer than a lot of real campaigns.
I have
a genuine question that I've been wanting to ask since I asked you to be on the podcast.
Yeah.
Do you know if anyone actually voted for you?
Yes.
People voted for you?
Like, yes. I know at least 5 or 6 people.
In New York or like outside?
All over the country.
Oh, my God.
People wrote my name. They, in a few examples, they will have counted as votes. It depends from state to state.
Yeah.
In New York, anyone who wrote my name in the write-in, it was like they were voiding their ballot.
For those who don't know, Connor ran for president. On the basis that he was 35.
Yeah. And how that came about was I was going to watch the Gethard Show most weeks.
Yeah.
And there was a week, I think, early on in the run, they were in like the small studio from one of the early episodes. And there's an episode where I showed up just to watch.
Yeah.
And I think Don Finelli was late. And Gethard was like, hey, Connor, do you want to sit on the panel? And I was like, okay. And I sat on the panel, and I really felt like I did a bad job. Like, I felt uncomfortable. I felt like I did not... And I was like, I don't really have, like... Like, some people have, like, a great personality that works on the show for the panel. You know, right. Like the people who are on the panel a lot, they just have these personalities that work for it. I really felt like my personality didn't work for it. So I was thinking, like, I want to have a thing on the show. And at that point, like, Gethard was, like, not wanting the people to come. I mean, since then, they've added some, you know, fictional characters to the world of the show and everything. But at that point, I felt like Gethard was more interested in, like, stuff that had more root in reality.
Right.
Like, he'd be more interested in you being some version of yourself. And so...
Which, of course, if you're playing Connor Ratliff, that's really you.
So I remember asking him in July, like, the first month the show was on, I remember asking him, like, hey, what if I ran for president on the show? And he's like, that's great. That's good. And I'm like, I'll be, like, the Gethard Show, like, presidential candidate. Yeah. And it was always my intention to have it go all the way through. I don't think many people realize how far in advance I was, like, planning stuff. But... My feeling was, like, I remember, like, another old reference, like, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
Yeah,
they
had,
like, a guy, there was a guy, Pat Paulsen, who would always run for president.
Yeah.
And my feeling was, like, my idea was, I always thought it was funny, like, 35, I always thought it was a funny age, and I was always kind of aware
it's
of,
the
like,
most random age that they could have chosen.
When you turn, well, because it means a different thing now than it used
right.
to, and... You know, like, being 35 a long time ago was a lot older than it is
right.
now. And I was just always had an awareness of it. Like, oh, when I turn 35, I'll be old enough to be president. Like, I thought that was funny. And I remember early on, like, I had an idea for that I would run for president and that it would be kind of ridiculous. And initially I had all these other complicated ideas for what I was going to do in the presidential campaign. Like, things that were kind of more, like, overtly, like, political satire.
Was it your idea for the debate between you and Jimmy McMillan?
Oh, I'll talk about that in a second. That was sort of my idea. Like a lot of things that happened in the campaign, it would start with my idea, and then other things would happen that would change
it.
Originally, it was going to be more like, kind of like, I'm really glad that I didn't do this. It would be more like of a political satire thing, and that I would be, like, I would be liberal and I'd be making fun of Republicans or something
yeah.
like it. And the first week when I was making that first campaign, I thought, you know, I'm just going to strip all that stuff out and just have the whole focus of my campaign be
your age.
That 35. And I can always add that stuff in later. And I remember Shannon O'Neill, after that first announcement week, I remember she said something that was like, that what was great about it was that it was so simple. And I remember thinking, like, oh, of course, like, that should be the only reason I'm running for president is because I'm old enough and I should be a single-issue candidate. And it was really – I might have screwed it up really badly if she hadn't said that.
Like, you have had, like, actual opinions.
Yeah, and I did have some as it went along.
Oh, I remember, like, distinctly towards the hug camp, like, the hugs.
Yeah, there was, like, weird things would play out, but I would always, like, realize, like, I need to bring it back to that I'm 35. Mm-hmm. Like, those things are a distraction.
Yeah.
And so – then I had that as a thing that I could keep coming back on the show. Now, other things, Noah Forman, who's one of the... Noah Forman and Drew Johnson are the writers for the Chris Gethard Show, like the head writers. And Noah sort of became the de facto... He became kind of like my co-writer for the campaign.
Right.
Sort of by accident. It sort of came about because Noah would say things... Like, I'd say to Noah what I was going to do, and then Noah would be like, oh, yeah, you should do this. And... whenever I would do a thing that Noah suggested I would do, it always worked. And whenever I didn't do something that he suggested I would do, it always backfire.
Yeah.
I remember one time he gave me a note on a video that was like, it's too long. And I'm like, nah, I like it this way. And then it aired, and I was like, ah, he was right, it's way too long. Like, it was one of those, like, Gethard turned to me as the video was airing. He's like, how long is this video going to go on?
I think it was there for, was that like towards the end of the campaign?
No, it was in the middle. It was
okay.
Originally, my idea, like, I would set up the ideas that would work either way. Like, I would set up an idea where I would say, I'm going to debate all the presidential candidates. Come to the show and we'll debate.
Right. Which ended up being Jimmy McMillan.
And the plan was that I would either get someone from one of those campaigns to come and be on the Gethard Show.
Yeah.
Or no one would agree. And then that episode, it would be a runner during the show, which would be Gethard would keep cutting to a debate set with me and, like, 12 empty podiums.
That's hilarious.
And... Noah Forman was the one who said, you should ask Jimmy McMillan to debate you. And I was like, well, that doesn't work because he's not running for president.
Yeah.
I need it to be people who are actually running for president. And Noah was like, oh, it'd still be funny. And then it turned out he was running for president. I just wasn't aware of it.
Yeah.
He was so far under the radar that I just assumed he always ran for governor or whatever he'd run for. But he was. And so I emailed, all the candidates. I was emailing all the candidates.
Did they all respond?
The only one that responded was the Romney campaign responded. They declined my offer of an interview. Like, it was a misunderstood even. Like, I was asking them to come on the show and debate me, and they were like, we cannot do your interview at this time, but please be in touch later on. Like, they were sort of, like, open-ended. But Jimmy McMillan, like, I emailed his contact person. He has a crazy website, if you look at his
website. I didn't know who he was until I watched that episode.
And,
which is insane to begin with.
I emailed his contact information, and I said, I want to have this debate on this show, the Chris Gethard Show, etc. And that was, like, at 2 in the morning I emailed him, and at 9 in the morning, the next morning, I had an email from this, like, his intern or whatever.
Yeah.
It was, like, this, like, someone like Brittany, who was, like, a NYU grad student or something. And she was like, Jimmy would very much like to be on this TV appearance. And so then Gethard, I remember Gethard saying whenever I was like trying to get people, and I remember, because at that point Gethard and I lived in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
I remember Gethard saying to me like, you know, we actually got like someone, we actually got Jimmy McMillan to show
You're
up for the show.
You're doing the Gethard hands right now.
And he's like, what if we had like an actual debate and the whole episode was a debate? It's like, can we actually do that shit? And then when I, like, emailed him, I'm like, Jimmy McMillan is in. He wants to do this debate. And so that immediately became, like, one of the first really crazy episodes of the show. That was, like, one of the first ones where, like, I remember showing up at MNN for that debate. And Jimmy McMillan was already there. His demands were that we had to, Gethard had to pay for a car service for Jimmy McMillan to and from MNN to Brooklyn. And so I got there, and Jimmy was already there. He had this black gloves, and he was doing his full get-up. And I was like, oh, shit. And so I walked over, and I was in my suit. And we didn't want him to get, like, thrown by, like, we didn't want him to feel like he was at a comedy show.
Yeah.
We didn't want him to feel like it was a joke, because we wanted to take it seriously. And so I was acting not like I recognized him. I was acting like I was a guest, too, you know? Like, it wasn't a show I was at every week.
Okay.
And so we did that episode, and I think Gethard got stuck with a bill for, like, hundreds of dollars for
Holy
that car service. I think Jimmy McMillan, like, kind of rips Gethard off. Like, I remember telling Gethard, like, how much the car service was. Or like, that there was, like, some, like, message from the car service that it was, like, hundreds of dollars.
Oh,
Gethard
my
was
God.
Like, what? And he was like, I think Jimmy McMillan just stuck me with the bill. And,
oh, my God.
Yeah, it was insane. And so a lot of stuff, but that was all off of Noah Foreman saying, like, let's do this. Similarly, like, you know, like, when I did in the middle of the campaign, I had this idea, like, I'm
going
to try to get one of the
friends
to be my vice president. And I just thought it was a funny idea.
One of the funnier ideas of
and
the whole campaign.
I thought it would be a fun thing for a few weeks that I'd just actively be trying, and I thought maybe people would be getting active on Twitter. And I knew that I would open. I knew I probably wouldn't hear from any of the main friends.
Yeah, yeah.
So my plan was to keep opening it out until it was, you know, like, what I was thinking I would end up with was someone very far away from the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I found a website for Larry Hankin, the guy who plays Mr. Heckles on Friends. He's, like, probably one of the top five recurring characters, even though he was just in the first couple of seasons.
Right, he was only in the season 4 or so, yeah.
Yeah, and but they brought him back, like, after they killed his character off, like, a flashback episode.
Yeah.
And I emailed him, and then I got his phone number, and I called him and left a message for him, and then he called me back, and he left that phone message saying, like,
yeah, I'll do it.
And he was really cool about it, and so that was, like...
Did you ever meet him?
Never have met him. I've talked to him on the
phone.
But,
like, so if you, in theory, if you ever, actually, if you did win the campaign, he would have been your vice president, whom you've never met.
I was kind of hoping that at some point I'd make it out to L.A. and we'd do a video or something.
Yeah.
But that was the thing where, like, just like with the Jimmy McMillan debate, like, I didn't think I was going to get someone that connected to the show to do it. And there'd be other things. Like, I went to South by Southwest, and, like, most of the fun things that happened came out of a spirit of, like, being willing to change what your first idea was in order to do something else. Like, at South by Southwest, someone in the audience asked if I'd be willing to wrestle the human fish in my underwear.
That in the video,
and that was probably one of the more fun moments of the campaign because I said, sure, I'll do it. Not in my suit, but I'll do it. Gethard, I'd driven over in the van with Gethard. Yeah. Gethard knew I just had the suit. I didn't have a change of clothes. And Gethard was like, you don't have any other clothes. And I'm like, I've got a surprise for everybody. And I went backstage, and when I ran out on stage wearing just my boxer briefs, right, that were like my presidential campaign branded boxer briefs, like nobody on in the show, like Gethard and Shannon, like if you watch the video, you can see they're genuinely like surprised by it. So the campaign was really, and the show allowed me to do things that would be like fun and surprising.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
That's and
awesome.
Yeah, so I mean, like, I don't know what other forum I could have ever found that would have allowed me to start a bit that weird and continue it for 15 months, I think.
Right, because it happened right before your birthday and a little after.
Yeah, and where, like, you know, I did, like, it averaged out at, like, a video a week for...
That's insane. That's insane.
And some of those videos were, like, you know, a 90-minute press conference, or, you know, like, some of those videos were, like, super intensive things, like, not, like, little web videos.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, I'm so amazed, like, by the fact, like, I'm really amazed that people actually really, truly voted for it. That's amazing.
Yeah. We did feel some guilt. I mean, if it had been a close election, I think I would have changed the narrative toward the end to be like, don't vote for someone else. Yeah. And then even like the election day special,
which I'm so mad I was not able to watch. Seeing photos of you having like a mental breakdown.
I'm hoping at some point it's all filmed. Like JD Amato has all the footage of it. Yeah. I don't know if it's. It may be.
I wish I'd seen it because I heard Gethard was like insane, like 2 hours.
And I never saw any of Gethard's half of it because we literally, like, I pitched the idea a year in advance. To Gethard, literally the week after the Jimmy McMillan debate, I said to him, you know what I'd love to do is have a Gethard Show election night special.
Yeah.
And Gethard was like, oh, you should email MNN, this person, see what they're doing. And then like a few months before, and so MNN was really into it because they love the Gethard Show at MNN. Yeah. Like it's their, like becoming, it's like their flagship show now.
Especially now, thanks to the whole iTunes thing.
Right, yeah.
Hopefully tonight people can watch him eating deviled eggs and stuff like that.
Yeah, hopefully. and so then MNN was totally into it. But then of course, my idea was like, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if we had a 2 hour long special on a different night of the week? And then Gethard was like, what if we did like 8 hours? Or no, what if we did like 4 or 5 hours? And then J.D. Amato was like, what if we did 12 hours? And it's like this weird game of...
Yeah.
And then they were like, what if we do 12 hours in two studios?
It was two studios.
The Gethard Show was happening in the main studio.
Right.
And my campaign headquarters was in the smaller studio in the same building. And I did over 10 hours... of broadcasting from
oh my God.
Simultaneously, like,
the
Gethard Show would cut to my studio once an hour, but I, like, we did almost 24 hours of election programming in 12 hours.
I didn't know that you were in two different studios.
Oh, yeah. So I have never seen most of what happened in the Gethard studio.
Oh.
I think J.D. Amato has all the footage.
I got to contact him about this. I don't know.
At this point, it would be so weird archivally because it's such a, like, of-the-moment thing.
Yeah.
But I hope at some point it's available to watch online. It's a lot of footage to get through.
Yeah.
But,
oh, my God. I didn't know that they used... Holy shit.
And, I mean...
Wow.
And just, like, it was so amazing because it was the longest simultaneous broadcast that New York Public Access has ever done. Or the longest unbroken show.
Right.
And it was, you know, had a sister program that was happening at the same time. And I know that stuff got just insane because, you know, that's a long time to be on the air.
Yeah, like,
you know?
People that were at the show told me, like, stuff that happened. Just sounded like, it sounded like it was kind of scary.
There was a point where a viewer in California ordered a pizza for me to be delivered to me.
And it didn't get delivered to
Gethard?
And
it got delivered to Gethard.
Yeah.
And the Gethard studio audience unanimously voted to eat my pizza. And I found out about this in the studio I was filming in. I found out of this at the point where I was hitting my lowest energy, and I was genuinely furious. Like, I remember I called from my studio. I called on my phone into the Gethard Show. I remember Gethard saying, like, this sounds like you are actually mad at me, not mad at me as, like, part of the bit. And at that moment, I was like, I can't believe you ate my pizza.
Oh,
and then,
my God.
Again, it was Noah Foreman's idea to... end the presidential campaign. Like, I had a couple of options. I thought I could either keep campaigning for 2016. That felt boring to me.
Right, because same thing.
One of my options was I could just disappear, and that's the end of the bit, and you never hear from me on the Gather Show, and I would only...
You should be really funny considering that in the alternate timeline, right. The future timeline, you're a crazy villain.
Yeah, yeah. But one of the ideas I generally thought of was, like, maybe I'll just do behind-the-scenes stuff. Like, I'll do a little short film, yeah. Or I'll come on in a disguise, but I'll never show up again as Connor Ratliff on the show. And then Noah Forman said, like, what if you immediately shift to going for the Olympics in 2016? And it felt like such a fun, like, I thought even if it was only just a button for the presidential campaign, yeah. It felt fun. Because I did have a full breakdown on election night. Like, I genuinely, like, I mean, it was acting, but I was genuinely crying tears as I was, like, begging to please not call the election. And... that would have been like a weirdly dark ending for a 15-month comedy bit. And so it felt it would have been a fine ending. Like, some people thought it was like over when I did that, yeah. When I was gone. But then I went upstairs and I shaved my beard and changed into a tight, form-fitting, ridiculous outfit and came down and made my Olympics announcement. And it just like, it felt for a show that is drenched in sadness, but whose core mission is about hope and optimism and trying to lose well and things like that, I thought like, oh, this would be perfect because we'll end on this like high note. Like, it felt wrong to end a 12-hour broadcast on a dismal disappearance and failure, you know.
Oh my god, the saddest ending of almost anything.
Yeah, and so like, I'm really proud of the way, I mean, like, I'm very grateful that I mean, Gethard's been, like, a real benefactor to me in comedy.
He's a good guy.
He's a great guy.
Really, I'm happy to call him at least an acquaintance. He's going to be on the show soon. Yeah. We literally have to figure out when he could be on the show.
And there's no other context in which I would have been able to do something as crazy as presidential campaign. And I felt good about it because I felt like it was such a... it was exactly what I wanted to do. And I also feel like it helps kind of build a small corner of the universe of the show in a good way.
Yeah.
Especially
since it was such a huge part of the show.
Yeah. And the Olympics thing, like, I genuinely didn't know on election night whether or not I would continue it as a bit.
Yeah.
Or whether I would just have it be, like, a funny non sequitur ending. As it was, I mean, I did say, like, going forward, the Olympics bit will be different in that, like, for the presidential one, I really felt like I kind of weirdly feel like I only have 15 months. I got to keep appearing on the show. Yeah. Whereas
this... The Olympics, you have 4 years.
I have 4 years, so I kind of feel like I can pace myself a little with it. I feel like if I do it too much,
people get
tired of it. Yeah. I probably am doing it too much for people who are following on Twitter or Tumblr. but I just genuinely wanted to make it... but I am committed now to... doing it. I think I did one performance at Upper Citizens Brigade.
Yeah.
That was
for the workout.
For the workout, which is a really weird weird
There's
show.
No one coming up, I think, right?
What?
There's no one coming up or
no, I don't have any other plan. Okay. I mean, I'd love to do another kind of show.
I was mad to miss it.
Because I literally they have a slot at UCB that sometimes performers use to work out new material. Yeah. It's called the workout. And I asked Nate Dern, the artistic director, can I use one of those workout slots and I'll just work out.
You literally just worked out.
I literally just worked out. And, well, there was comedy to it, too. I had a video that had, like, text and footage and stuff like that. So there were funny things happening. But
it was mainly, like, you, like...
All I did for half hour was... No, it was stupider than that. It was mostly me, Don Finelli, and Darcy Carden doing aerobics. They were literally just copying whatever I did. And so it was very stupid.
Oh, let me see.
But fun.
Since we're getting close to wrapping up, I always like to ask, what are you interested in that's coming up that's not a plug for you?
What am I interested in?
Like a movie or like
TV well, I want to see, Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Season 3, very excited about that. Very excited about Arrested Development on Netflix. Steven Soderbergh's new film, Side Effects, I want to see that. I'm a huge Soderbergh fan.
Yeah, I saw it. I'll be reviewing
it
on Monday's
episode. Don't give me spoilers, but did you like it?
You'll find out on Monday.
All right.
Yeah.
I will say I'm watching House of Cards on Netflix.
Same here. I'm like 5 episodes in.
I'm about exactly the same place.
I'm enjoying the sandwich that it is.
I think House of Cards is really good. I would put it in the realm of certain shows that are quality but not my favorite shows.
Yes.
Like, I think it's like a Boardwalk Empire.
I've never watched it. It's actually in my apartment, the first disc right now.
Boardwalk Empire gets really good as it goes along. I think season 3 is the best season of Boardwalk Empire.
Good enough.
But my feeling of House of Cards, and I don't mean to like damn it with faint praise, but I think a lot of the consensus has been this, which is that, this is how I phrase it, I find it, I'd be surprised if it was anyone's favorite show.
Okay.
But it's a good hard show to not like, because it's really well made and interesting. I'm really curious to see where it's going. But I will say, I do have an opinion about that. There's been a lot written about like the way that Netflix just releases everything at once.
Yeah.
And they're saying like, well, that's how people watch shows now. They binge watch shows. And I feel like it's almost like it's sometimes fun to have pizza at midnight, but it would kind of suck if pizza places were only open at midnight.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like one of the things I love about TV, serialized TV, is that it is episodic, and I feel like the original release of it should have, like, I would be much more excited about, I think what Netflix would do, and I actually would like to start a campaign to make this happen.
Let's do it.
Because I think it could happen. I still release it fast.
Yeah.
But I'm dreading the 14 episodes in one day.
Because there's no way I'm not going to watch that in one day.
But it's not going to be as fun to watch it. Like, when they aired the last 4 episodes on a Friday night after the Olympics, it was not as much fun as if they'd done it even over four days.
What I think they should do is 2 weeks.
Or 1 week.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, because, like, with House of Cards, it's been great. It was, like, 7 episodes the first week, 6 episodes the next week, and then just enjoy. Like,
but
watch.
Here's what I think would be ideal. Because it kills the buzz of it. Like House of Cards buzz peaked last week.
Yeah.
And
now everyone's just trying to digest it.
Now it's just like whether you saw it or whether you're caught up or not.
Yeah.
You're either caught up or you're catching up. But it doesn't have that same feeling that like when a show is unraveling, everyone's like experiencing it together. Arrested Development, 14 episodes in 2 weeks. That's an episode every day for 14 days. That's still intensely
fast. That's a lot.
Fast.
Yeah, that's really fast.
But it gives every episode its own weight. It gives, if people want to binge watch it, they can skip a few days and binge watch those. That's probably the way it would happen with a lot of people anyway, but it would give the fan community
time to
sense. Yeah. Like, there is an Arrested Development fan community that deserves to be able to savor it in a way that 14 episodes at midnight on a Sunday night is not going to do.
Yeah.
I really do genuinely feel like there's too much at stake for it to just be like, here's glop, here's all your episodes that you're ever going to get. It feels gross.
But there's a movie coming out soon, so that's good.
Well, we hope. We hope.
Exactly.
I am passionately, for years, there have been people, you'll see them online commenting, saying like, no, the show ended perfectly. There should never be a movie. I could not disagree more. The TV show ended with a call forward saying maybe a movie.
Yeah.
If they don't make a movie, that call forward is sad.
Yes.
If they do make a movie, that call forward is amazing.
Yeah.
And people who say it ended perfectly, I understand the
fear. Oh, I understand, yeah.
I understand the fear that it might not be
good. Rudy Barrett and I were talking about today that, like, if any of those 14 episodes are bad, it's terrible.
Yeah. I don't think they will be. But
I don't think so either.
I understand the fear, but it's still, they got to do it. They committed in the last episode of the show, maybe a movie, and at that point, that wasn't a joke. At that point, Mitch Hurwitz was talking loudly on the sets about how we could make a movie. Yeah, it's got to happen.
All right.
So those are my plugs in my soapbox.
Cool. Well, what about plugs for yourself?
Plugs for myself.
Like Twitter, Tumblr, shows. I know you don't do much improv or anything like that.
Stepfathers.
The best improv show.
Friday night.
Yeah. I reviewed the Stepfathers once on here.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. What happened was I was caught up with like movies and like plays, and I saw Stepfathers like the night before I was recording. It was the one where you guys were, the second half was like, the suggestion was like in the end, and like you were like pecking at like Delaney's like intestines, like half of it. And,
was
like,
it the where there was all
afterlife? Like afterlife, yeah.
That was the one where I humped people's legs.
Yeah,
right. They were like,
and they everyone like basically attacked Gethard and stuff like that.
Yeah, there was a scene where it was in hell
where
and
you were like some
Will
demon.
Will Hines and Gethard.
Will Hines and Delaney.
Will Hines and Delaney first. Yeah. That's what it was.
So I remember like crying. Like,
they initiated that their hands were bound and they were strung up so they couldn't move. So I walked in and started humping their legs
as like some demon. Baby. As,
a,
like, look
as
in
a
the
demon
eye.
Where I would look them in the eye. Yeah. Yeah, go see Stepfathers Friday nights at 9 o'clock.
$10 you'll spend.
$10, well-reviewed by the New York Times.
Get your tickets early now, too, like on a Monday or Tuesday.
Or if you can't do that, do the standby line. You know, like, it's worth trying. I'm too fragile for this. There's another new episode soon. And
it's really funny, guys.
Tom Levin directs them. It's me and Catherine Mudon. And it's one of the things I'm proudest of. it kind of is like, it's hard to describe, but if you look up I'm Too Fragile for This on YouTube.
It's really nice. It's two great actors, they're very funny.
Catherine Mudon, I think, is one of the, judging like there's, in the UCB community, there's all different kinds of performers.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of really funny performers that are very writerly performers that are like, great performers, but they have like a different energy. And then there's some who are very actorly. And I think just as far as pure acting goes, I think Catherine Mudon is one of the best actors at UCB.
I completely agree, yeah.
And doing this web series with her, I always feel like it's so, she makes it so easy because I just see like, oh, what level is she acting at? And I just kind of like try to match that level. Not quality-wise, but just like how big are we being, sort of.
Yeah, of course.
And it has worked because I think my acting is better in those than I think it would be otherwise.
And I know you have a really great Twitter feed.
Just Connor Ratliff on Twitter, or you can follow my Olympic campaign at Ratliff 2016 Gold. I've retired my 35 Ratliff 2012.
Oh, boo. And you tumble?
Tumblr is Connor Ratliff as well. And Ratliff 2016 Gold. Same
Such
Tumblr.
A long Tumblr.
Yeah. And I would also say, if I was going to plug anything, if you want a good, fun, like, summary of my presidential campaign, all my old presidential videos are still up on YouTube, but there's an episode of the Chris Gethard Show that the day after the election, it was my documentary, Old Enough to Be President.
And it's a great, it's really
fun. It's like a 40-minute thing that covers most of the high points.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but most of the high points of the campaign.
And you'll see previous Hit the Mark guest Kevin Hines in the episode.
Kevin Hines plays a big part. Yeah. Actually, one of the most fun videos of me on YouTube, just that, for me to enjoy, for my pure enjoyment, is he played my pollster in the campaign.
Yeah.
And we did an actual focus group. That was one of the
That's
things we
so
actually
funny.
We actually organized on Craigslist a real focus group. They never knew it was a joke. And Will Hines ran it like it was a real focus group. He kept him in there for 90 minutes, even though the
Wait, Will or Kevin?
Will Hines.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Kevin Hines was the guest. Oh no, Kevin Hines was my rapid response. Sorry.
Right.
Wrong Hines.
Hey, at least he didn't bring up Brian.
That's right, or Booyar. That's an obscure Hines reference. He's not a Hines, I'm often told, but I always call him Booyar Hines. That won't make sense to anybody.
Except for like 10 people.
10 people at UCB. Kevin Hines was my rapid response, which was the job he chose, and he chose to be very, very slow. Will Hines was my pollster. We organized this focus group, and he ran it so convincingly and so engagingly that even though they'd only agreed to be there for 35 minutes, they stayed for 90 minutes without complaint.
That's insane.
But there's video of us interacting, lots of little short videos of me and Will Hines. And one of them that's on my Connor Ratliff YouTube account is outtakes of when Will and I couldn't stop laughing. And it's just like in the same way that like the Debbie Downer SNL sketch.
Yeah.
I could watch it a million times because watching people trying not to laugh and laughing is hilarious.
It's the funniest thing.
So infectious. Yeah. Watching Will Hines breaking again and again and breaking me is great. It's so much fun.
Awesome. All right, my plugs quickly, of course, at MarkLevy85 is my Twitter. Tumblr's hitthemarkpodcast.tumblr.com. If you want to email the show, hgmpod@gmail.com. Send me questions, whatever, if you want to be on the show or whatever, or anything, just let me know. Show's coming up. This last time I'm plugging it because it's happening this Sunday, February 17th at Queen's Secret Improv Club at 6 p.m., $5. Come see Life After Kevin. It's a tournament show, kind of like Cage Match, so please come and you vote for us. And if you drink, you can vote for us more. Just found out about this. We will be an ovulating show on the 25th at Queen's Secret Improv Club at 8 p.m., where we will be doing Kronf opening, which I've actually never done before, which I'll be learning between now and the 25th, and then doing a montage afterwards. Soon I'll be promoting Second Honeymoon's March show. I'd love for you to be in that. We'll talk about that later.
All right, yeah.
But thank you so much, Connor.
Oh, thanks for
this
having me.
This has been like the quickest 99-minute episode of any podcast
so
ever.
So I talked on a chat.
No, dude, that's great. I love it. I love it, and they're going to love it too. So,
hey, congratulations to anyone who listened to the end of me talking for this long.
And I'll see